right, everyone. It is Monday. It's, by the way, spectacular in New Hampshire. I don't know what the weather's like in Iowa because tonight's the caucus, but New Hampshire, balmy. February 3rd, Monday, Iowa caucus. Tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Lively show today. It's our Rethink the Week. There is so much to talk about. But, of course, the upcoming caucus tonight, we're all going to be on edge. I'm doing some radio nationally tonight, and actually the rest of the week is, like, insane. I tell you, Chris, I'm on Chris Hayes' show twice on MSNBC. Watch me on Thursday night on Chris Hayes. Watch me on Monday night on Chris Hayes. Watch me on ABC on Friday night. Watch me on ABC on Tuesday night. I think they went alphabetically. I think that's what happened. They got to C and then they stopped. So I'm just so lucky I'm an A. Aww. Anyway, so it's going to be a wild couple of days. No question about it. And it'll be interesting because I think what's really frightening to me, Ken, is how much – we'll talk about this in the second half of the show, but how much Mayor Bloomberg is weighing over everything. I mean, his name now comes in almost every other sentence, which is really scary.
And what'll happen if he gets a box?
Oh, hold on. What happens if he gets a box? Anyway, that was Ron Abramson. He'll be joining us for our Rethink the Week. I did not have his mic up. But let's talk about that fabulous, fabulous tweet I saw this morning, what they did in Des Moines, Iowa. I thought it was absolutely freaking brilliant.
It was brilliant. Great. It was great. Voters in Des Moines, Iowa woke up this morning with more than a dozen cage installations all over town. And it's Kids in Cages and the organization, the wonderful organization in Texas called AICES, R-A-I-C-E-S, is doing great work on the border, helping families that are seeking asylum here, not separating families, not putting them in cages. And it's still going on. You know,
of course the
country and talking heads are talking about lots of issues, the impeachment and all the issues that they talk about in the Democratic debates and everything. But immigration is like the issue that was cool last year and not so cool anymore. The rotating media cycles.
Well, actually, everything is now frozen. Donald Trump has changed everything. Everything, because everything is nuclear. Everything is nuclear.
But they want to remind people that, indeed, our country is still separating families, placing kids in cages. I met some of those families when I was down in Brownsville, Texas, Matamoros, Mexico last month. There are plenty more, and it's just horrible. So the voters in Iowa are reminded. Hopefully they will pay attention and think about this is not what America is supposed to be about. The Statue of Liberty is the symbol of America. We welcome people. We're all a nation of immigrants.
Can you imagine if somebody could do an installation around the Statue of Liberty and put a cage around her? And people have done some amazing things with the Statue of Liberty.
Well, who saw the Super Bowl halftime show? There were some young people in cage-like construction during the halftime show, which showed two very strong Latina women.
Wow.
So it was powerful.
Thank. Well, what I think is so amazing was not only did they wake up to these cages everywhere in Des Moines, but the signs on the cages says, "Don't look away."
Right.
Don't look away. That was the part that I started to cry because it was so powerful. Again, this is where people don't understand. It's the visual stuff that really punches through. You can have Facebook ads. You can have ads on TV. But to wake up and see that, not only was it effective, I think, in Des Moines, but it was incredibly effective because think of the free media now that it's getting and we're all talking about it because it was so amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
And the don't look away sign, the hashtag and the signs have been around. People in Brownsville were wearing them when I was there. And the fact of the matter is that our country has looked away.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We continue to look away. Do you know that more than 60,000 asylum seekers have been sent back to Mexico by our government? It's
frightening.
Unbelievable. There are more than 50,000 of them there now in tent camps on the other side of the border, like I described last month.
Yeah. No.
It's still going on, and it's not even talked about. We are looking away, and we should not.
Well, that's why we're doing this show, because we're trying to make sure that we constantly loop back and loop back and loop back so we don't forget these things. So I appreciate the fact that you've actually impressed upon me in a really positive way. So thank you, Ken, because I make sure that whenever I see it, I post something because I want people to see it as well.
Great. Can I just say one more thing? And that is that there's something called the Migrant Justice Platform. And there's a hashtag, Migrant Justice Platform. And I urge people to check it out. And there are things that we can ask our legislators and Congress members to do, and there are things that grassroots people can do as well, just like this cage demonstration in Iowa.
Yeah, no, it's always important for people to begin to constantly remind people about our inhumanity. And what is so interesting about what you talked about just now is that my aside for today, everyone, I reached out to the author of the article at theconversation.com. Here's the title of the piece. Supreme Court allows public charge clause that kept Nazi-era refugees from the United States. Mm-hmm. So she connects it back to the Holocaust. And it's just incredible. She is an expert, a historian, and I'm going to try to reach her because, again, we've been talking about the public charge. Mark Stern talked about the public charge. Right. We had some folks in the Immigration Hub talking about it. You can't talk about it enough because it's so inhumane. But just the idea of connecting it to this brings people a sense of what this means then and how it is so important to discuss now. So
You're going to talk. I know you're going to talk about Bloomberg later, but this is the pre-entry. If you're rich, you can come into the country. If you're poor,
exactly.
Not so much.
Exactly.
Well, and the great irony that the architect of all this is likely Stephen Miller, who is Jewish.
Someone should send him the conversation, or actually we should all send it to him. We should have 1,000 copies show up on his desk. All right, today is our Rethink the Week. We're going to be joined shortly by Dean Spiliotis, a professor at Southern New Hampshire University, a civic scholar, a presidential scholar. He has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. You hear him on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have in studio now the famous Ron Abramson of Elizabeth Warren's ads, fabulous ads. He's walking the streets with her. And tell the audience a little bit about the ad. What is the sort of the point of it and why your tagline became really the descriptor for this ad?
The campaign has identified Elizabeth Warren as the best unity candidate for the party.
Right.
And they brought three of us from different prior backgrounds, political backgrounds, me, a former Bernie delegate,
right,
a woman who was a Hillary supporter, and a woman who until about 6 months ago was a registered Republican.
Wow.
And all of us very enthusiastically support Elizabeth Warren. So they shot some footage and put it together. And other than my awful hair day, it was a really great ad.
And tell us the last line. And it was extemporaneously. So what was the last thing that you said that became the tagline for the ad? Because I think it speaks volumes about why it was such a powerful ad.
That if we have the courage to unify, we will win.
Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal. And joining us right now by phone is Russ Muirhead. He's a professor of government at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, also the head of the government department. Welcome to the program, Russ.
Hi, Arnie. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. So we have Ron Abramson and shortly Dean Spiliotis will be in studio as well. Just a real quick comment, because I think this is so important about what Elizabeth Warren is now doing with her ads. I'm just hoping that it's not too late. And we were just talking about the fact that Ron Abramson was in one of her more recent ads where it was a former Hillary supporter, a former Republican, and a former Bernie supporter talking about how she could really thread the different camps of the party together. And I also think that the other thing that she does so effectively is that when she talked about all her plans, which are so remarkable, it shows that she's thought about this stuff. It shows how knowledgeable she is about what are the challenges going forward and that there are solutions for those challenges. I think that's the other thing. I think, in a way, the plans are about hope as much as they are about plans. But one of the things I thought, Russ, was that, you know, she always says, I have a plan for this. What I wanted her to sort of morph into was people like you saw in the ad with Ron Abramson, where people say, no, 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 she has a plan for me. And that's
right.
The power of her ads. She has a plan for me, and I'm, you know, I live in some barrio. She has a plan for me. I live, you know, outside of New Orleans. Or she has a plan for me, and I live in Detroit, Michigan. So people really understand that what she is talking about is really what people are being challenged by.
Yeah, I think, it caused me to remember way back in one of the first town hall debates. Somebody asked, you know, at the time Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush and candidate Bill Clinton, you know, what does the deficit mean to you personally? And Herbert Walker Bush looked at the person, couldn't process the question at all. And you know, Bill Clinton gave a kind of heartfelt answer. And, yeah, I think we're not just coming up with plans to abstract problems of public policy.
Right.
This isn't a seminar. This is real politics. And when you say you need a plan for me, it means you're addressing, you understand what it is to occupy the situation I occupy. And that's going to be in your mind when you're in office.
Ron, so I listen to MSNBC and CNN, and it's just polluted with elites. It's polluted with people who keep talking about how great the economy is. It's polluted with people who talk about how wild the stock market is. It's talking about all these things, and I am looking at them going, and how many jobs do you have to get to your job? You know, and how many times have you lost your health care? And how many times have your kids said to you, Mom, I'm going into more and more debt? You know, I just posted on Facebook, Ron, the list of countries where the cost of college is zero. Is zero. And it's staggering when you look at it. And then you look at the next level, which is the cost of countries where the cost of college is under $2,000. And it's staggering. And I'm looking at us. We've just gotten so used to costing too much and accepting the burden of debt. And I think that's part of the problem for the Bernies and the Elizabeths and many of the not even the progressives, but the Democrats that are running, is that the kind of debt that we've accepted should not be acceptable. That's the only word I can use. Ron?
It reminds me of Noam Chomsky's observation about how once you cripple people with debt, it's much easier to control them.
Yes.
You have many fewer choices. You can't speak out as much. And that's been true for a lot of us. And there seems to be this sort of hyper-capitalistic sense where we create a profit motive for all sorts of areas and industries that shouldn't have a profit motive, like
healthcare.
Prisons and healthcare and education. Right. And then we—
And the military.
And then we don't really provide legitimate opportunities to earn enough to pay that back.
Yeah.
That the all this wealth—
Well, you're an indentured servant is what you become.
But it doesn't – none of that flows back to people— who work. I mean, very little flows back to the people who work as opposed to the people at the top. And you just observed that Michael Bloomberg is worth 10 times more now than he was, 15 years ago?
Yeah, when he ran for mayor. He ran for mayor, everyone. Dean Spiliotis has just joined us. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. And actually, we're going to get into Bloomberg in the second half of the show, but I did tweet something out that I retweeted, and it was wealth inequality. And this was the tweet. It's so cute, though, because it's from CBS News, and they're so shocked that it surprised people. And it said, the richest 1% controls more wealth now than at any time in more than 50 years. But what does wealth inequality really look like, Dean Spiliotis? And what they did was they took a pie and they used a piece of pie to show people.
Everybody
was so shocked. And I'm thinking, but this was the first time CBS News ever did the pie thing. I mean, they could have done the pie thing 9 years ago. They could have done the pie thing 8 years ago. And yet now all of a sudden, this is they're surprised at the reaction. And I am crushed because we don't talk about it. And now, finally, it's something that even CBS can not only talk about but tweet about.
Income redistribution, you're saying. Yeah, it's going to be a big part of the fall campaign. It's been a big part of the Democratic primary. It was of the last one as well in 2016. We already know what the Republican playbook is going to be. They're going to scare the crap out of people and say that, whoever the Democratic nominee is, whether it's Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, are going to be Trump is already saying communist. And he's saying, hey, Bernie. He just said, actually, if you heard the clip, but didn't Bernie get married in Moscow? And people are like, no, that was the honeymoon, not the actual wedding ceremony. So, they've already got their playbook down.
Was the president jealous about that?
Yeah, it was unclear, right? Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Was there a Trump Tower there?
Well, sometimes the irony, I think, is a little lost on him. But but that's where we're headed, regardless that, they're going to try to scare people that a move towards any democratic socialism or socialism or even Medicare for all or some sort of a revised tax code is going to deprive you of your liberty and your financial independence. I mean, that's what the argument's going to be. And it's a debate we'll have, and we'll see how voters you know, how voters
fill
out.
And God knows the income inequality issue is a class war led by Karl Marx. I
mean, yeah, that's exactly right. So Russ, tonight is the Iowa caucus, and they are predicting the largest turnout for a caucus ever, but that's still not a lot of people. I hate to break it to you. But anyway, it's supposed to be huge. And the other thing that's just, I think, also fascinating is, again, I keep saying this over and over again, it's the youth participation, because they have bent over backwards, Russ, to bring young people in. I was reading a story the other day that high schools, because 17-year-olds who will turn 18 in November, they can participate in this caucus. So this is, you know, they've never been able to do this before. So high schools have been actually doing practice caucuses. They've really been inspiring their 17-year-olds to
extra
participate.
Credit for caucusing.
Exactly. And the 16-year-olds are now saying, damn it, I'm not 17 yet. So what they're doing, I think, is kind of inspirational from a civics perspective. But here's what I thought about it. I want to sort of get your reaction, being both you and Dean being professors. And that is, I go back to what happened with Parkland. And it was those young people that really gave us the courage to sort of take on the NRA. And then I go back and I think about Greta. And Greta really has sort of inspired us to recognize that this is not about climate change. This is about a climate crisis. And, you know, we were doomed yesterday, let alone what's going to happen tomorrow. And then I look at this incredible potential for turnout in Iowa. And I think if you can see young people doing something significant in Iowa, it will not stop in Iowa. I think that it would actually create some kind of real inspiration and almost a challenge to young people in the 49 other states. Guess what? We are the future, and we make the difference now. Russ?
And that I think is especially true in a caucus setup. It doesn't take that many new entrants into the process to really change the outcome.
Right.
A few thousand people might be enough. Caucuses are just really kind of, you know, time-intensive and weird ways of choosing delegates to the national convention. So, yeah, a little bit of a change on the intake is going to make a massive change in the output. You know, whether that really changes primary states and we get a sort of flood of young voters, I don't know. But you're right. Like, this is a big constituency for the Democratic Party. It's one that the nominee is eventually going to have to inspire to have a chance in the fall.
So I was reading an article the other day, and they said that the definition of the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders is that Bernie Sanders is more of an absolutist and Elizabeth Warren is willing to compromise. So, Ron, since you've been on both sides of the track, you supported Bernie. The same track. Right, exactly. Well, that's what I kind of said. Anyway, but it's 2016 and you were with Bernie, and now it's 2020 and you're with Elizabeth Warren. And Elizabeth Warren seemed to take a hit when she sort of stumbled on the healthcare piece. But the concept of compromise versus sort of more absolute is interesting, because I think in a lot of ways it's not actually accurate about Bernie, but it's how he packages himself. Ron?
Well, I'm 51, not 21, so I try to work for the world I want but understand the world I'm in. And
that's a great line.
It's at the end of the day, I just had a Twitter thread for me go pretty viral. About 1,500 people responded to it or retweeted it. And it was just a summary, because I started to take some backlash from Bernie people, both whom I know and don't know, about appearing in an Elizabeth Warren ad and really about supporting Elizabeth Warren. And it's for me, it comes down to, with two people who have very similar priorities and values, who is likely to be more effective in getting more of their agenda through. And when the very hateful, which is a minority of the Bernie supporters, lash out, I want to ask them, if you could get 30% of Bernie's agenda through with Bernie in office, or 60% of that agenda through with someone else in office, if you knew that was a given, who would you choose? Is this a movement, or is it a cult of personality?
Well, and that's what's so scary for me, Dean. And, you know, maybe it's because I am a politician in recovery and I've been around politicians virtually most of my life.
You're not in recovery.
I'm not in recovery. No, shut up. I've been going to AA meetings. It just hasn't worked, you know. So Dean, but one of the things I just keep thinking about is I've been around some people I totally admire, but there are pieces of them that disappoint me. And yet I'm not disappointed in them. You know, I'm willing to understand that they have limits, that they make mistakes, that they don't say the right thing. I think Bernie understands compromise. He just never uses the word. And that doesn't mean that he won't do it. But in a lot of ways, I almost feel like we have created these black and white scenarios. And yet if you ask people how they raise their children, if you ask people how they go to work, they know it ain't black and white. Why suddenly, you know, you run for office and somehow everything changes, especially with the cult of personality with Trump and the cult of personality with Bernie, which I find more cultish than almost anybody else.
Yeah, you know, the main difference between Sanders and Warren is that they've both been hit with similar criticisms. I think it was somewhat more focused on Elizabeth Warren because she was surging over the summer and right. A lot of people were writing Bernie off as it wasn't going to happen for him the second time around. That's now flipped a little bit. But, you know, they took the same criticism. He continued to package his agenda in terms of absolutes. And she started to talk a little bit about transitions and, you know, we may get a certain way, but it's going to be a gradual process. You know, sort of a nod to kind of the reality of the situation. I often laugh when I read on Twitter, never Trumpers who say they're perfectly fine voting with Bernie because he's not going to be able to get any of what he wants done once he's in office. So they don't feel particularly threatened because nothing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of argument that we're having right now. On the younger voters, you know, because Russ, I talk to them all the time in class. It's fascinating to me that Bernie is the oldest candidate in the field, oldest candidate of anybody, like 78 now, 77, mm-hmm. 78, he's older than Biden, does best with young voters. Mm-hmm. And Pete Buttigieg, who's only 37, mm-hmm. doesn't do particularly well with young voters. He does well with older voters. Right. So it's something about the idealism. They certainly they're much more comfortable with concepts of democratic socialism. They like Medicare for all. They want student debt reduced. They're hard to predict. 2004, Iowa was going to go to Howard Dean because the orange-capped young volunteers were all going to descend on Iowa. Didn't materialize. But 2008, we had a big spike in youth participation for Barack Obama.
Right.
Whether we're going to get back to that again, I think social media certainly helps.
Right.
There's been a lot more focused organization from outside groups on student involvement and registration. So the potential is there. It's just hard to predict exactly what kind of impact they will actually have in the end.
So I have two things, Russ, I have in front of me. I have a Time magazine article that says how the Democratic Party missed the power of Bernie Sanders again. That's the first one. And then, of course, there are a whole series of articles coming out about how the Democratic Party is trying to make sure they undermine Bernie so he doesn't succeed. So I'm just trying to figure out what does the Democratic Party actually think they stand for, Russ?
Well,
I'm just kind of curious.
Question,
yeah.
Look, what is the Democratic Party? There's no little club of people who are the Democratic Party. They're people who run for office and call themselves Democrats and who care about the cause. And there's no membership fee and there's no membership list.
I think that may not be true.
I get enough emails to contradict both of those premises.
Go on, Russ.
Yeah. I mean, if you think, you know, there is a Democratic Party, then, you know, that's controlling the outcome of this nomination contest,
right.
Then you're making a mistake. There are people who care about the cause, and they're asking themselves one question. What's going to be most effective in the fall?
Right.
This is going to be a very, very difficult election to win. And a lot of Democrats think that Bernie Sanders can't win in the fall. It's a good faith estimate of his probability. It's not a comment on his character. It's not even a comment on his campaign.
Yeah.
And there are others who think that Bernie has the best chance of all the candidates to win in the fall.
I know.
And I don't know of any science that can really determine the answer this far out.
But there are polls
out
to support both of those positions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, so let me just say,
so it's a good faith disagreement.
Yeah.
Let's not pin it on the Democratic Party. There are people who just don't think Bernie is the person who can beat Trump. That's a perfectly plausible statement to make.
I don't disagree with that, Russ. But let me just say something. So a really thoughtful person. This is to show that you're right on a lot of levels. He wrote me a note. He's probably the smartest person I ever knew in the New Hampshire legislature. I mean, the smartest. All right. So just to let you know how thoughtful this guy is. And he said, Arnie, I'm out of my mind. I don't know what I'm going to do on Tuesday. My heart goes with Warren and Bernie. It is the policies I believe in. It's what I know will repair this country. It's how we move forward. But I am so terrified about what you just said that I'm looking at Mayor Pete and I'm looking at Amy Klobuchar. Notice Biden isn't even in the mix. I just want everyone to pay. I mean, that's what. But this is the contrast. He does not know what to do. Look at those four people. It is just, in a way, so shocking that that's where he's trying to figure he should navigate. And I think you're right, Russ, but I think at this point in time, electability, since nobody has a crystal ball, don't you go where you think the passion is, Russ?
That's a good strategy. I mean, I think without any passion, you're not going to do very well in a general election campaign. At the same time, look, what's going to win in November is not a movement of people who agree with each other. It's a coalition, a broad, cacophonous, untidy coalition of people who disagree with each other, but who can stand together for the sake of beating Trump. The question is, who can form that coalition? And it's a hard question to answer. I think to say I'm going to go with the person who can inspire passion is a really good way of answering it. It's as good as any other, but it's not the only way.
Can I just say, Russ, that I certainly agree with you that the vast majority of Democrats are simply engaged in a good faith determination of who can win in November. And I would go out on a limb even further and say that probably a very substantial number of Republicans are also feeling in good faith what they think the overall best thing for the country would be in terms of a candidate. In other words, the people that held their nose and about all the terrible things about Donald Trump but thought he'd be good for the economy or whatever it was. But I don't think that everybody on either side is simply good faith calculating who's going to win. I think there's a lot of issues about, going back to Noam Chomsky, but not even that far, of corporate power. And the Democratic Party and many, many Democratic candidates are united with the corporate elite and powerful corporations on Wall Street and the banks and frankly, the health insurance companies.
Remember what Mitt Romney said. Corporations are people too, my
friend.
There we go.
We've got to take a break. All right.
There are power issues as well as just a good faith.
Right. Money does filter into this conversation, and I think it does impact what the DNC does. I said the DNC should not be called the Democratic National Committee. It should be called the Democratic National Abacus. And on that note, a little labor history is next. This is the Attitude with Artie Artisan and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was a day of tragedy for the workers at the Thiokol Chemical Corporation plant in southeastern Georgia. An explosion killed 27 workers and injured dozens more. Explosive material meant for the Vietnam War had instead detonated in Georgia. In the early 1960s, NASA had contracted with the company to build solid rocket motors for the space program. Thiokol acquired 7,400 acres of land at Horse Pen Bluff, an isolated area of land that used to be a plantation. The company built a large 36-building complex. As orders from the space program waned, the company shifted its production to pesticides and munitions. One item they produced was trip flares for use in the Vietnam War. A trip flare is employed by a military operation to secure an area. A flare is connected to a tripwire and ignites if it is triggered. The highly flammable magnesium is a key ingredient to the flares. A fire started in one of the buildings of the plant. The employees were able to evacuate quickly, but they did not leave the area, not realizing the danger of a potential explosion. When the blast came, it could be felt as far as 50 miles away. Some of the victims were hurled 400 feet in the air. An investigation found that explosive materials had been improperly labeled and that the company's fire protection system was woefully inadequate, contributing to the loss of life. After a drawn-out legal battle, victims of the disaster won a federal lawsuit against the company for their negligence. The Vietnam War had taken an unexpected toll on the working people who gave their lives, making trip flares for the battlefront.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The land in the Mississippi River Delta is sinking and eroding. Louisiana has lost about 2,000 square miles since the 1930s. And as seas rise, the loss of land will only accelerate. If nothing is done to slow this loss, Louisiana could lose an area more than twice the size of the state of Rhode Island in the next 50 years. Among U.S. coastal regions,
our land is going underwater faster than anywhere else.
Pat Forbes directs the Louisiana Office of Community Development. He says the state's coastline is a precious cultural and economic resource. Louisiana is home to a huge fishing industry. It's among the top oil and gas producing states, and 500 million tons of cargo pass through its ports and channels each year.
We have a lot of people working in our coast and living in our coast. We have to figure out ways to adapt to this changing reality.
The state has approved a $50 billion plan to rebuild land, build flood barriers, and implement other projects such as elevating homes. But Forbes says even if the plan is implemented in full, some places cannot be saved.
Some communities are going to disappear.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. He can commit murder and get off free. Live in the governor's company. But if you are poor, people tell you, shoo, a dog is better than you.
Do I have to stop this song? Money is King. This is the Attitude Authority artist and producer Ken Barnes. We picked that song. Who sings Money is King?
That is Layla McCalla, and I just thought it was a wonderful tribute to the campaign.
Exactly. Joining us from Dartmouth College is Russ Muirhead. He is the head of the government department. Joining us in studio is Ron Abramson. He's an immigration lawyer and an Elizabeth Warren supporter. Need to make sure people know that. And Dean Spiliotis is a professor at Southern New Hampshire University, civic scholar and a presidential scholar. So I'm going to start with Dean. So, Dean, one of the reasons why I wanted to play Money is King is that I wrote the following tweet last night. Folks are suggesting that Bloomberg is running in case the Dems pick the wrong candidate. So why do we think at a time we're seeing the greatest gap between rich and poor that the billionaires know what is the right candidate? Why do we attribute all these virtues to rich billionaires? They know how to pick the candidates. They know how to pick the products. They know how to pick. I mean, think about this. Because you're rich, all of a sudden everything should be assumed about you, including what makes sense in November of 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a little bit of projection. I don't think that Bloomberg thinks that he's a more virtuous candidate than anyone else. I just think he thinks he's better positioned to beat Trump. This is like a strategic and tactical decision. He simply believes that Sanders can't win and some of the other candidates can't win, and he feels like he's better positioned to do that. I don't know. It's not even really an issue of kind of right or wrong. It's just sort of a tactical and strategic calculation, and he's willing to spend a lot of money. And this is going to be a fascinating test. If we come out of the first four contests and there's still three or four people in the mix, you know, I've listened to and read a variety of commentary on what Bloomberg has been doing. He's got full staffs in states that people never campaign in. And so we'll see. Maybe he'll get traction on Super Tuesday. Maybe he won't. But it's a fascinating experiment. He has spent, I think, over $200 million at this point, which is mind-blowing.
Amazing. Steyer has actually spent more.
More than really?
Yes, yeah. but more than
Bloomberg.
Marginally more.
But let me just say, but Steyer has spent more over a year.
A longer period.
And Steyer has had to spend more in order to get those little tiny contributions. Mm-hmm. So remember, all Bloomberg does is go to his bank account.
Correct.
So let me just ask a question. Russ, have we ever had anyone who said no to contributions and run for president? Ever in the history of America?
Who said no to all? Well,
yes.
You can't say no to all contributions.
Yes. All he said, absolutely, I will not take a thin dime from anyone.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting? And, and so one of the reasons why that's offensive to me, Russ, is that I raised lots of money when I ran for governor. But I raised lots of money with people gave me rolls of pennies, literally rolls of pennies to contribute to my campaign. And you know why? Because I reminded them it wasn't my campaign, that it was our campaign. This feels so much like not only is Michael Bloomberg saying no to your money, it's about the fact that he is really – it's not about us. It's about him. He will tell you how he'll campaign. He'll tell you why he campaigns. He'll tell you how he raises his money from his bank account. It just feels so despotic.
Interesting. I mean, lots of small donations obviously don't really, you know, render a candidate beholden to any particular donor. And that's the model that you're just describing for your own campaign. That's been the model for Bernie. That was the model for Obama. And, you know, a candidate who's beholden to, you know, Goldman Sachs for several, you know, hundreds of thousand, for checks of $200,000, $300,000 is in a different situation.
Yeah.
They know where they're getting their money from, and they know who they have to please. So I think, you know, Bloomberg, who's not going to get lots of small donations, nobody's going to send a guy with
them.
Tens of billions of dollars, you know, they're 25 cents.
Russ, he's refusing them. He is one of the reasons why they had to change the terms of the debate, was that the terms of the debate where you needed to get X number of contributions from so many states in, you know, whatever the amounts were, and he would not be able to qualify because one of the statements from the very beginning of his campaign is, I will not accept a contribution. So therefore, in order for him to participate, the contribution limits and the numbers had to disappear because otherwise you couldn't play by the Bloomberg rules, not the DNC rules.
Could I just say that obviously you're right. No candidate has run for president and refused to take any donor contributions. But that's because nobody could afford to do what Bloomberg is doing. You know, he's not getting the bad money out of politics, the donors trying to control you. He's basically saying, I'm the only donor and it's all about me and nobody else. Is that what we want our politics to look like, that unless you're a multi-billionaire, you can't run for president?
So Ron, I mean, answer that question. But I think more important than just answering that question is that we know that when he bought the mayor's race in New York City, he had a wealth of $5 billion in 2002. In 2020, his wealth, we think, is between $54 and $55 billion. So he's seen an 11-fold increase. And if you're successful in buying New York City with 8 million people, you probably can clearly buy the country with $55 billion. He's shown the pattern before. He's exercising that pattern again.
Absolutely correct. And I mean, we're not even talking about the fact that he is such a calculating pragmatist that he became a Republican in order to do all of this.
Exactly.
We're barely touching on that issue lately. And I mean, he was a keynote speaker at which RNC in 2004, maybe. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And, you know, people like to point out anybody who has been less than completely consistent, which in non-political parlance is called growth or evolution. But it's extraordinarily troubling. And I mean, we all have seen the toxicity in the political arena increase multiple fold since Citizens United, since this money has been able to flood in with very little accountability as to who is spending how much for which candidate.
All right. So let me just stop you there because, Dean, it didn't matter whether we had Citizens United. It didn't matter whether we had Buckley v. Valeo. When you cut your own check and you say, I need it from nobody, you know what he represents? He represents the grotesque increase in wealth with the 1%. You're right. He might not have been able to buy it at $5 billion, but he can clearly buy it at $55 billion. And Bezos could buy a couple of countries at the same time with his billions. So I think part of the problem here, Dean, is this a success strategy for Democrats if we're trying to figure out who's got the Velcro to hold people together?
We don't know.
I know.
The short answer is we don't know. It might work, and if it works, I expect we'll see more of it. You know, in reality, some of what we might see with Bloomberg is what we saw with Trump. Some voters think this is a super successful, wealthy guy. He must know what he's doing. He's figured out the system. Let's see what he can do with the country. And you may see the same kind of, you know, logic with Bloomberg among Democrats. I have no idea if that's going to work. But if it does work, we'll see more of it because there are increasing number of billionaires and multi-millionaires who can do this kind of thing, whether it's a presidential race. We see it all the time now for Senate races. You know, Linda McMahon, Vince McMahon's wife in Connecticut, who's the head of the Small Business Administration.
Right.
She ran for Senate twice. Spent $100 million of their personal fortune,
and lost both times.
Right. Exactly. So this is increasingly
common.
Carly Fiorina.
Exactly. So, Russ, the other issue is, so we don't know what the economy is going to be like in November of 2020. We don't know what the planet's going to be like at the end in November of 2020. What we do know right now is that we may be in the face of a pandemic because of coronavirus. And I'm obviously very concerned about that, only not like everybody else is concerned. We're all concerned about it. But I have a daughter in Shanghai. And my daughter in Shanghai sent me a note, Ron, and here was the note that she sent me. that there is a rumor, and you know how rumor is going to be spreading everywhere because nobody believes, nobody trusts the Chinese government the way we don't trust Donald Trump. I mean, I just need to lay that on the ground.
The rumor will spread faster than the coronavirus.
Exactly. Well, and here is the rumor in China, Russ, that it's the Americans that created this virus. This is what she sent me last night, okay? This is my daughter who just got locked into her compound. They came by and shut the metal gates. She is locked into her compound. They are not opening schools. They are checking everyone, and you're not allowed to come back after the Chinese New Year's because if you left Shanghai, you might have gone to a place where you could be contaminated. The economy is grinding to a halt. And here's the interesting thing. Not only is Donald Trump not prepared for this because he's drained so many of the resources out of our public health system and our ability to face global pandemics. But here was an interesting story from August. In August, I read a story about how many of our drugs come from China. So this is also going to be fascinating as we talk about picking a candidate, because this might affect the economy as well as our health care, Russ.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're right. I mean, some people look at Trump and they see a candidate, an official and a candidate who's unusual. He's got some very, you know, distinct qualities.
Right.
But he's like any other. And others look at him and say,
that's the most euphemistic thing I've heard in ages.
Yeah, he's being euphemistic. Okay, keep going, Russ.
Yeah, I mean, he's a threat. He's a threat to the fundamental structure of constitutional democracy. And that if the, you know, if the system is challenged from some outside force like this, like pestilence, like a... massive global crisis, the danger of having somebody like Trump in the presidency will become, will rise to emergency levels.
Yeah.
And look, that's why I think somebody like Bloomberg is running. He thinks that this is an emergency time, and he doesn't really expect to win. I think he'd rather see somebody else win, but if he has to, do everything he can to challenge the incumbent, he will. And so it's not just it's another election where Democrats ask themselves, you know, what does it take for a Democrat to beat the Republican? It's an election where a lot of people are thinking, how do we maintain, constitutional democracy in the United States?
Well, you know, so Russ, as I was thinking about this, I'm going to toss it to you, Ron, because I go back to the hurricane. And the reason I go back to Trump and the hurricane is I'm just praying that everyone in the administration is taking Sharpies away from President Trump. Because if there is a problem, and we're beginning to see some cases being diagnosed, we know that, you know, we have to be concerned about this because we do have such an incredible relationship with China. If you need to trust the people that are speaking to you, you need to trust them. And what Donald Trump has absolutely done is that nobody trusts him. And yet he is leading this, you know, decision of how we're going to prepare for this possible global pandemic. And I just think that this is going to be a really interesting come to Jesus moment, because I understand that they're going to basically walk away from impeaching the president no matter what he did. How are these same people going to go back to their constituents when the leader in chief is the liar in chief and can't be trusted about talking about a hurricane, let alone a pandemic?
It's hard to say whether these are unintended consequences, but here we are. And that's exactly right. I mean, the entire crux of modern conservatism has been less government.
Right.
But less government doesn't mean to just absolutely destroy all institutions and create distrust and, you know, active resentment or animosity towards people who are, in fact, keeping things running and trying to work for the public good. And this is a great example. You mentioned the president and the hurricane with the Sharpie. You know, I was just thinking about George W. Bush and heck of a job Brownie back in,
New Orleans, Katrina.
And
exactly.
Just what happens when we become so cynical that we put in people who align with us or we impose loyalty tests instead of recognizing that these are important professional positions with incredibly high stakes. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it at every turn. We're seeing it with the environment. We're seeing it with public health scares. We're seeing it with immigration. We're seeing it across the board.
Well, and it's so interesting, Dean, because one of the things I mentioned at the very beginning of the show was a story about comparing the public charge that has just been sort of reinvigorated by the Trump administration on legal immigrants. Mm-hmm. I just want everyone to know this is about legal immigrants. It's not about illegal immigrants. And they basically said because of the public charge rule, a lot of folks could not enter into the United States during the time of the Holocaust, that it was the public charge that kept them from coming into this country. It's an article at theconversation.com. And the other thing about the public charge rule being reinvigorated now is that just when you want to make sure that people access the kind of necessary health care and public health and Medicaid, whatever it is that they will need in something like that, he would do this. This also is a national security issue for us because the timing couldn't be worse, Dean.
Yeah, and he's expanded the travel ban.
Right.
He just recently on the stump at the rallies started talking about how he's still building the wall. And so we're getting into an election season. In his mind, taking these kinds of moves on immigration and bringing back a strong rhetoric at his campaign rallies is a winning strategy. It didn't work so well for him in 2018, but he seems to be trying it again, and we'll see whether it resonates in 2020. But it's not a surprise to me that we're seeing an uptick in these kinds of expanded travel ban, the charge issue, talking about the wall again, all the kinds of stuff that he thinks is a winning way to mobilize his core group of voters.
We have not spoken about it, but they're talking about it right now on the floor of the Senate, and that is impeachment, Russ Muirhead. So right call, wrong call by the Democrats. Should they have moved ahead?
I don't think it'll hurt the Democrats.
Okay.
Whether it will help them, I don't know. Maybe. I still think there's an important civic dimension to it. Trump crossed a certain kind of line when he conditioned congressionally appropriated aid to an ally on that country investigating its political opponent. And that's an impeachable offense. The House has now defined it that way. And I think future occupants of the White House will remember that. But I don't think it was necessarily ever about removing him from office 8 months before an election. It was about defining a certain kind of behavior as a high crime and misdemeanor.
Ron, you saw what Lindsey Graham said. So in case my audience does not know, Lindsey Graham warns the GOP will investigate not only the whistleblower if Donald Trump gets reelected, but they will investigate Biden if he gets elected, and he could possibly face an impeachment trial. This headline is terrifying. Mm. I mean, of all the headlines I've seen, Lindsey Graham has gone completely nuts. But that he would now take up that bloody shirt of threatening him with an impeachment before he even,
well,
emerges.
It would only be if they take back the House, though, Arnie. There's no way impeachment's going to go through the House.
I understand that. Yeah. But so let's talk about the sophistication of what you just said. Yeah. And let's talk about the headline that basically terrifies everyone. Because even if it's not about the House, even if they have to take back the House, the idea that this would be the threat as you're going into 20.
It's like a Benghazi thing all over again.
Yeah, exactly. Ron?
Well, imagine imagine a scenario. I saw this. Someone tweeted this, where the president's reelected, but somehow the Democrats take a supermajority in the Senate of 67 people. The precedent is about to be set that the president could then be removed with no witnesses and no evidence.
Yes.
And that's basically – we are all so short-sighted right now and all so tribalized and thinking about momentary political gain that we have really sold our future short and have not thought much of this through. To answer your original question, from my perspective, I feel like the Democrats did the right thing but didn't do it in the best way. And
now, what would the best way have been? Adam Schiff said, we did the best we could. There was nothing else we could do. And I'm just trying to figure out what other rabbit could they have pulled out of the hat in order to make this, I don't know, more engaging, more more theatrical.
That's not what I mean. Right. I mean stepping back and sort of ending up either boxed or boxing themselves on the lack of certain witnesses during the House proceedings who may or may not have come to testify in the Senate proceedings, had two votes gone slightly differently. It's it seemed to be a very difficult situation, because how do you decide to impeach a president about one discrete thing when there are arguably dozens of violations and of the office of the Constitution?
And let me just say another thing, because as you're talking about this, what I'm thinking about, Dean, is that the problem with foreign policy is that the president has so much damn latitude. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's almost the hardest place to have anything stick. Everything else, you could sort of see some, you know, limits. But when it comes to foreign policy, we almost give him a blank check. It's kind of depressing to me. But that's, I mean, look at, when was the last time we declared war? You know, World War II. There we go. Oh my God! But I mean, think about this. You know, we've been in perpetual war, but yet Congress has never exercised their authority. So that means the president has a license to do anything. So I understand why, because of the connection directly to an election, that they used the Ukraine aid as a raison d'être. But at the same time, foreign policy becomes such a problem.
Yeah, well, you know, presidents have historically had tremendous latitude in foreign policy. And when Congress has not intended them to have it, they've claimed it nonetheless and figured out ways around attempts by Congress to take that power back. I mean, you can go all the way back to George Washington and find examples. But it really starts with Teddy Roosevelt, the turn of the 20th century. And then it just strengthens on and on through World War I, World War II, and other various military conflicts. So the intention, I believe, behind this, certainly with the founders, was to speak externally with a single voice to lessen the likelihood of threat from foreign adversaries, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, in extreme examples, presidents have interpreted as basically a carte blanche. You know, they take an Article 2 says you take an oath to preserve.
That's the Republicans' line.
Yes, you preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. You can use that phrase to justify pretty much anything. I had to do it. I'm preserving the Constitution. And that's how Trump views it. Right, exactly.
And I am the same. Exactly. Yes, Ken, quickly.
I just wanted to get back to what you said about Lindsey Graham's comments, because I think the scariest part about that is the extent it shows that our democracy is being undermined. His threats and his bullying tactics, it sounds like Il Duce's, the brown shirts. And it's like thuggery.
It is
instead
thuggery.
Of democracy. Yeah. The Gestapo is going to get you if you don't do what we say.
And scary. Russ, go on, Russ. Russ, I was going to go to you. Yes,
Russ? I mean, this connects to maybe the one thing about impeachment that I wish did go a little differently is that I wish more attention was paid to the second article of impeachment, which had to do with presidential obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. And not as much attention was paid to that, but it's you know, maybe even the more important article of impeachment against Trump. And you know, Trump's view was that Congress—it's not the role of Congress to hold the executive accountable; it's rather the role of the executive to hold the legislature accountable. And this turns, you know, the separation of powers constitution on its head. Yeah,
exactly. So, Russ, before I let the three of you go, I want to just talk a little bit about Mary Louise Kelly and what happened with Pompeo. And I just, you know, it is so shocking. And I tweeted out the other day that I thought that John Bolton should do the following, that he should tomorrow night at 8 o'clock sit down with Mary Louise Kelly and spill his guts an hour before the State of the Union. Because if we think that Michael Bloomberg is now a worm in Donald Trump's head, imagine if NPR sat down with John Bolton just before he had to address the nation. First of all, NPR would probably have bigger ratings than the State of the Union. And second of all, it would be chaos. And I just think if there's revenge, it would be doubly sweet right about then. But the Mary Louise Kelly thing, Ron, that just is so disturbing. Pompeo is smart. Pompeo is smart. What happened to him, too? Oh, Russ, I don't know.
I know. I don't know how smart he is, but he seems to have a fairly loose grasp of constitutional essentials, even though he preaches about freedom of the press when he travels abroad.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't really seem to understand what it means when the rubber hits the road.
But yeah, this whole administration's been about chutzpah. I mean, we saw a $10 million Trump ad during the Super Bowl about criminal justice reform, which is one of the few things with which I agree and applaud the administration for getting it done. But as I said to my wife after that ad, I said, let's just not ask about Mexicans. I mean, there's no commitment to real justice. And, you know, the cynical view is, well, Jared Kushner had a personal stake in this, and a bunch of people who could be facing prison at some point in the future wanted to make sure that the criminal justice system was reformed.
Before they got there. Before they had to wear an orange jumpsuit. I mean, I think the interesting thing about the NPR thing is that it was not surprising in a lot of ways, but it was so petty. We've seen this happen with the Speaker of the House in New Hampshire. Remember with the Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis. Yeah.
Petty and unsurprising in my book.
Yeah, petty and unsurprising. Well, yes. On that note, I think we end Rethink the Week. It is the night of the Iowa caucus, which will not be petty, but it may be surprising. Anyway, thank you so much, Russ Muirhead from Dartmouth College. Thank you, Ron Abramson, immigration lawyer. And thank you, Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. We end with what, sir?
We end with a tribute to Bloomberg and the others, Baby, You're a Rich Man
Here
by
we go.
The Beatles.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
That you know.